This week on Pop of Culture, we're on tour with the Book of Mormon.
But I think the most gratifying part is learning how different regions appreciate different aspects of the show.
We'll fire up downtown Muncie.
It is an event that we can be proud of, and it belongs to every single one of us, and everybody is invited to it.
And we'll continue our conversations between the coasts.
When you drive out past the Walmart, you really do feel like you've landed on the moon.
Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. In today's show, we'll fire up downtown.
We'll continue our conversations between the coasts.
And we'll check in with John Mellencamp.
What? Wow. But first, ding dong. Craig Franke is touring with the musical The Book of Mormon, which will take the stage at Emmons Auditorium at Ball State University on Tuesday, September 24th. And lucky for us, he's here to talk about the show. Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Hello, everybody.
First off, I have to admit, full disclosure, I am a huge fan of this musical. I cannot remember a time where I laughed so hard, like stomach hurting, tears rolling down the face at a musical before. So just wanted to get that out of the way so that we're upfront and honest about where we are and where I am, as I'm a huge fan of this musical. So, but for those who have not seen The Book of Mormon, Craig, can you give us a little description in a sentence or two?
Yes, well, The Book of Mormon is a story about two Mormon missionaries, I think, with high hopes to be sent to a fabulous location for their mission, and instead they are sent to Uganda, and they realize maybe they are not as well equipped to convert people to Mormonism and save the world like they thought they were going to before they were sent out. And it's a 9-time Tony Award winning musical. It's written by the creators of South Park. It's been called the funniest musical of all time, the funniest musical of this century. So if you're looking to laugh, this is definitely the show for you to come and see.
Absolutely. So tell us a little about your role, Elder McKinley, in The Book of Mormon. And what do you love most about playing this character?
Elder McKinley is such a sweet and kooky guy. I think that's what I like most about him. He's got such a good heart, and he is the leader of the mission that our two main missionaries, Elder Price and Elder Cunningham, are sent to. Yes. So he's been in Uganda for 3 months now, and as they arrive, he gives them some pointers on how to maybe manage their expectations and emotions now that their missions have officially started. And yeah, without giving too much away, he has a great song right when you meet him. And yes. I'd say that's my favorite part of the show every night. But I don't want to give too much away because I think the charm of that song is it's best the first time that you hear it. So.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. It's my favorite song in the musical as well. Hey, you spent some time being a Hoosier as a musical theater student at IU, how does it feel to swing back through Indiana this time as part of a touring production?
Oh, it's great. We were fortunate enough to go to Bloomington in January of 2023. So it's been a little while since I've been there, but I know the best part about Indiana are the college towns. Yeah. And so I'm excited to experience a new one in Muncie, and I'm sad we're not there for long enough for me to take a little trip down to Bloomington, but I'll turn southwest and wave.
I'm sure they'll feel the good vibes. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. So what is the best part about hitting the road with a touring production? And what I would love is if you have any great tour stories to share with us.
Well, the best part about touring is just falling in love with areas that you didn't even know existed. You know, we're performers. We're not geography enthusiasts. So we all get to experience areas of the country that we didn't really ever consider. I'm trying to think of a good, funny tour story. I mean, I think it's not really a good story, but I think the most gratifying part is learning how different regions appreciate different aspects of the show. I think that's a very fascinating aspect of Tour, whereas like if we were on Broadway, it's, you know, an audience from New York with maybe a bunch of tourists every night, which is great. But yeah, we get to know how Muncie feels about the show, or like Sioux Falls, South Dakota. You know, that was a great, great experience for us. We went there early on and we were blown away by it. It's a, you know, a town in South Dakota that has a ton of statues, or Pensacola Beach. We went to Pensacola and got to, you know, experience the white sand and have a day there. So you get to travel the country for free and get to tell this story, which is, you know, I try not to take that for granted.
Oh, I love that. And the show deals with some sensitive themes through a lot, as we mentioned before, a lot of humor. As you're traveling around, what are the responses? What's the feedback you're getting as you're going to these different locations around the country?
You know, I would say that the feedback has been wholly very, very positive. Yes, it is written by the creators of South Park, so it is not necessarily maybe kid-friendly for the youngest of children,
right?
But I think towards the end, if you let some of the swear words and crude material, if you're willing to forgive, I think the message and story is very human and life-affirming. And if you can stay with us for long enough, I don't think you'll regret it. And I don't think anybody who has stayed along has regretted it.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So what brought you to this touring production? What was it about the Book of Mormon that you said, oh, I've got to be a part of this?
Oh, I mean, I loved the humor. I saw the show right when it came out. I grew up in New York. So right when I heard some of the music and I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever heard, especially as, you know, a 14-year-old boy. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I have to see the show.
Yes.
I begged my mom and she finally took me one Christmas, and I loved it ever since I had heard it. And so to be a part of it is such a full circle moment, and it's been so great.
Oh, I love that. So how long will you be on the road this time out? How does a touring production work?
Yeah, so usually you sign up for about 10 months. So this is where this is just now starting, like our third set of dates and locations. So we're at the very, very beginning. We just opened in Chicago on September 10th. So the good thing about Muncie is they're getting us when we're fresh. Like, we're not going to be tired yet. We're not going to be bogged down by traveling too much. It's an early stop, and we're all going to be super excited and raring to go. And we're there for one night only. And,
yes,
and sometimes those are the best audiences, too, because they're excited to experience just us for the one night. So
absolutely, absolutely. I know that there will probably be a lot of Ball State's musical theater students listening to this podcast when it comes out. What advice would you give them?
Oh, what advice would I give them? Whatever you're feeling self-conscious about, you're in school right now, that's the time to attack it. If you feel like you're not a strong dancer, you might as well take as many dance classes as you can, because you'll never be in a more supportive environment when you're in college. If you're in New York and you want to improve your skills, say you're not super confident as a singer, it's expensive. And and so is college, but you might as well take advantage of it while you're there. And from one Indiana college student to another, good luck. Keep working hard, and you know, everything will work out as long as you're willing to persevere, I think.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And I love that you are coming to town with this musical. I, along with, oh, I don't know, a few thousand of my closest friends in Muncie will be there to support you and the rest of the cast. Really looking forward to it. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Yes, likewise. Thank you for having me.
Craig Franke plays Elder McKinley in the North American tour of The Book of Mormon. The show visits Emmons Auditorium on Tuesday, September 24th.
The Art Museum at Indiana University unveiled a new exhibit this month with a Hoosier artist more known for his music.
The exhibit, titled Crossroads, the Paintings of John Mellencamp, spans several decades of work coming from a handful of private collections and Mellencamp's personal gallery.
The exhibit description says Mellencamp has created works of art that express a conflicted and often dark view of America, especially the plight of Americans living in the Midwest who have felt abandoned and overlooked.
One visitor, Greg Morris, says he went to the exhibit because he grew up listening to Mellencamp songs.
I was wanting to see about his art, if it was on par with this career in music. It is.
Mellencamp has said he's always been an artist, but found music to be a more stable career.
The collection will be on display at the Sidney and Lois Eskenazi Museum of Art through December 15th. Fire Up Downtown is this Saturday, September 21st in Muncie.
I will be among the dozens of volunteers at this year's event, so I made my way downtown to learn more. I am in one of the offices of the Downtown Development Partnership, and I gotta say, there's a lot going on in here. There are inflatable costumes and banners and ducks with flames on them. Of course, I'm talking about Cheryl Crowder's office as she gets ready for Fire Up Downtown. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us, which I know is a very, very busy, busy time for you.
I so appreciate you inviting me.
So tell us all about Fire Up Downtown. First, let's get the details, like when it is, where it is, all of the hours. Give us that first.
Okay, so Fire Up Downtown is Saturday, September 21st, from 1 p.m. to 10 p.m. in the streets of downtown Muncie. Very much the middle part of downtown will be blocked off, and it will be filled with a variety of activities for everyone.
Awesome. Tell me a little bit about the history of this event. How many fire-ups have there been? How did it come about? And why is it still probably one of the city's most popular events every year?
So this will be our third year for Fire Up Downtown. And originally, it was supposed to be a one and done. It was supposed to be this culmination of lots of events that we've done over the past that saw their time and, you know, just didn't work anymore. But we still had these amazing histories. Yes. So with the hot air balloons that'll be downtown, that's a little bit of summer heat.
Yes.
A lot of the food vendors, the ribs, the rib fest. Mm-hmm. Some of the performers in the Freaky Tiki Friday parking lot, was a little throwback to Freaky Tiki Friday.
Yes.
You know, we've got flames and fire and costumes and all kinds of the things, a little reminiscent of Muncie Gras. So just taking all of those events that were individually great events but don't happen anymore and smushing them all together into one great big day. So that was the original plan. And it went so well that we had to do it a second year.
Yes. I remember that first year. And I remember before the first year's event even ended, people were wanting to know the date for the next year.
So, absolutely. Yeah. So, yes, by public demand, it was back. And then last year, that was going to be the last one. And after you've done it two times, you're like, you know, this will be much easier the third year. Mm-hmm. So, and the public still wanted it.
Yeah.
So here we are, September 21st. We're doing it all over again.
And let's just put it out there right now. The balloons are going up.
The balloons are going up.
They are going up. They're saying it right now.
Third time's a charm. So
we've got that good mojo working. And let's talk about the balloons, because these are some very unique. If you're not familiar, when you think of a hot air balloon, you think of like, you know, just your simple, the rounded form with colors. And those are fantastic. We love those. But these are a little more interesting. Could you talk a little bit about the balloons?
Yeah, sure. So these are special shaped balloons, and they do not leave the ground. They just inflate downtown because we have buildings and wires and things like that that don't make it real conducive to launching them.
Right.
But we have these special shapes. So there's like Ellie the elephant, and she is an elephant-shaped balloon. Crispy Bacon.
One of my favorites.
He is just this gigantic pig. I think he's 110 feet tall.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. So there are these five special shaped balloons, and they will all inflate basically at dusk. They'll all be on the southern end of downtown.
Okay.
We will also have two tethered balloons.
Great.
One at Cannon Commons and one in the AccuTech parking lot.
Wow.
And you can actually buy a ticket to ride on those. So those do leave the ground. They don't fly away. They're tethered.
Mm-hmm.
But it's $20 a ticket, and we'll get as many people up in the air for rides on those as we can. And then the twinkle baskets, which is just the basket of the balloon, where they pull the fire. So
yes.
what the fire that uses, that inflates the balloons.
Yes.
You can see that, and it's pretty cool.
It's beautiful at night.
And then also, while all of this is going on, we have four flyover balloons. So early evening, these flyover balloons, four of them, will fly over downtown and over Cannon Commons.
That's lovely. I did not know about the flyover. That is so exciting. That's going to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And there will be, oh my goodness, from start to finish, there are so many things. Cheryl, do you want to talk about just some of the new things that are going on this year at the event?
Yeah, so I think the biggest new thing is Downtown Idol.
Yes.
So we have put it out there into the universe that we were going to do this. We have a second stage at Main and Walnut Street where this will happen. And that's kind of the contest stage. So that stage during the day will host the rib eating contest between the police and the fire department,
mm-hmm.
the hot pepper eating contest that AccuTech is sponsoring, Rockstar Bingo, who you are.
I was going to say, that sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rockstar Bingo, we love that one. And then we're doing Idol in the evening. So that is from 6 to 8 p.m. And right now we have 22 contestants.
Whoa!
For Idol. So super pleased with how that has gone. Mikey Mason's going to be the MC.
Love it.
We've got four judges who are super excited to be there. And it will be the inaugural event for Downtown Idol. So maybe it can fly on its own eventually later.
Yeah.
But this year, it's another one of those things. We can just keep smushing things into the day.
This one I'm really excited about because I love that it's all ages.
Yep.
And there are going to be more than 20 entered. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
We have a lot of local talent. So I'm excited to see who's going to be on the stage
for
Downtown Idol. That's wonderful.
Wait.
Speaking of talent, mm-hmm. oh my goodness, Cheryl. I was taking a look at the live music stage.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Seriously, if you don't find something in there to get you moving, to get your feet moving, and to get you dancing, I would be surprised.
We try to find something for everyone.
Oh my goodness, that is a lineup. That it was one after the other, and I was looking at the schedule the other day. I was like, okay, I'm going to have to catch a few songs here, then run over to the other stage, then come back for this. Yeah, so plan accordingly. Make sure you have the schedule with you so
Bring
you know what's going on. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Another big part of Fire Up Downtown is the Maker's Market.
Absolutely. Miss Moth Danner, she is an amazing force. She brings mm-hmm. us yard every year.
Yes.
She does Maker's Markets. And she puts together all of the makers for Fire Up Downtown. In the past, we've had 50 or more vendors.
Wow.
That we interspersed throughout the event with all of the food vendors and community information and all of that. And she has done it again this year. So, yes, so much variety. So
yes.
many different things to check out and to buy. They're, yeah.
And she brings them all together.
We are freaking talented, folks. We really are.
Yes, I agree 100%.
Yeah.
But that's not all. We just listed 7,000 things. That's not even close to being everything. There are activities and shows out the wazoo. Cheryl, one more time, remind people when it is, what time, and where.
So September 21st mm-hmm. from 1 p.m. to 10 p.m. in the streets of downtown Muncie, Walnut Street specifically from Main to the roundabout and everything inside of it.
Tell me, Cheryl, why are events like this important for downtown Muncie?
Well, I think that for our community pride. I mean, I think that it is a wonderful way for people to get to experience downtown and learn about the businesses that are down here, but also to like really enjoy this this neighborhood, you know, and it is a neighborhood for everybody. We say that all the time, yes. And we really mean it. So I feel like it is an event that we can be proud of, and it belongs to every single one of us, and everybody is invited to it. And this is how we show our love for Muncie.
Yeah, it makes you feel good.
Yeah.
You know, when I come out to events downtown and I see so many people from all over the community, it, like you said, I get that feeling like, yep, this is downtown Muncie, yeah. And it's how it should be. Yeah. And thank you for putting in all of the effort and the long hours to make events like this happen, Cheryl.
Well, thank you for much the opportunity, folks.
All right, we'll see everyone at Fire Up Downtown.
Yes, we will. See you there.
Cheryl Crowder is the events director for the Muncie Downtown Development Partnership. We spoke in her office downtown. You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. In our continuing Conversations Between the Coasts segment, we talk with artists who choose to live and work outside the arts hubs. Think New York, LA, or Chicago. So we're here today with Catherine Trishman, playwright extraordinaire, who has had work performed, produced pretty much everywhere. Catherine, your biography is extensive. You've had plays produced all across the country and all around the world.
I have. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you today, Jen.
So tell us about your journey, Catherine. Tell us where you started and why you decided to be a theater artist, how you decided. Some of us don't even decide. Some of us just sort of wind up doing this. And so how did that start for you?
I like to say that I came to playwriting through process of elimination. I was one of those kids and teenagers who just had to create all the time. Whether it was dance or choreography, acting, bad poems, I just was always creating. And I went to college certainly with the performance bug, but I think pretty quickly it became clear that I did not have the necessary tools to be a professional actor.
same here. And right. I also love, if I could say to you, how bad poetry is often a theme, because I have notebooks full of it.
Yes, I think there's something, poetry is such a wonderful form for when you're full of angst and 15.
Totally.
Right. So it was probably my first love of writing, but all my 15-year-old poems were very bad, of course. And then as you get older, you realize, oh, writing poems is incredibly hard and requires a level of just such pristine word choice and originality and a real love.
It isn't just, you know, blahing on a page. It's actually like craft. And
that's right. That's right. So I had to move on from poetry, but I have this distinct memory of being in a play in college, and the director asked us to write character bios for the characters that we were playing. And I turned mine in. And the director and the assistant director and everyone who read it was like, oh, my goodness, this character bio is amazing. It's so well written. And it was really clear that my character bio was much more impressive than my acting.
It could be that you were just not giving yourself enough credit. But it also, I think, has to do with how much fun it probably was writing the bio. Is that true?
I think I just had more talent as a writer than I did as an actor. And it took me a little bit of time to figure that out. But really, by my mid-20s, everyone kept encouraging my writing and being a little about my acting. And so I started getting serious about my writing. And I'm originally from Athens, Georgia, and I did my MFA in playwriting at the University of Georgia.
All right. And where did you go to college initially?
I went to college at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And what was extraordinary about that experience is that we had a black box theater. We did 12 shows a year in the black box theater, and it was completely student produced, student directed, student run.
Wow.
So we just had this playground space, and the folks who came out of that space are extraordinary. And I think that honestly was the most extraordinary education that I had.
We're actually doing the thing instead of sitting in a classroom learning about the thing. You're actually just sort of put in a room together and said, you know, make art.
Right. I was doing the thing with really bright people, really committed people, even though we were young, and we would do silly things like someone would read, you know, a Brecht essay and decide that we needed to, you know, produce Brecht in the style as he intended, whatever that means to a 21-year-old. But then we would do that.
And for our audience, Bertolt Brecht is a theater artist who came up with this idea of alienation theater, which sounds like it would be a lot of fun to play with in like a black box situation.
And so, of course, the shows were terrible, probably, in retrospect, but it was such an extraordinary learning process. And also, it taught us so much just about being a professional theater artist, because at the end of the day, half the time you do need to self-produce. There are certain times in your career where you want to self-produce. And having done that for 4 years was great.
Sure. And it's that sense of actually going out and making something happen rather than sitting around waiting for something to come to you.
That's right.
Yeah. So you were in, you got your MFA in Georgia. And then after that, what else? What happened next?
After I got my MFA, I did do the Fringe Festival circuit. So I had a play done at the New York Fringe Festival. And then I took a play to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So again, I was taking that model of self-producing and doing your own work and taking the work to exciting places, and also giving myself sort of a deadline to finish pieces and an opportunity to create work with friends, honestly.
Right. And that deadline is super important, because it keeps you from just kind of, you know, sitting and letting it ferment in your brain or on your computer or typewriter or whatever. Right. It's important to have that time when you get the work out there and actually share it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the play that I took to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is a little play called Crooked, and it's just a 3-character play with 3 women. And I wrote it for my friends. And that play, rather extraordinarily, was my professional breakout play and took me on a great journey. It was my first professional premiere. I got my first agent, and just it opened a lot of doors for me professionally.
And that started because you self-produced it at Edinburgh, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. So then after Crooked, then what?
Well, then this is where it gets interesting in terms of my geography. So my husband is a philosophy professor, and at the time we were actually living in D.C., and I was, you know, starting this playwriting career, and he was starting his philosophy career. As you can imagine, we really just didn't have any money and or health insurance.
And
he got this tenure track job at Fort Hays State University. It's out on the Great Plains in the middle of nowhere in western Kansas. And at the time, we just, you know, we needed the money. We needed some security. And we thought, oh, we'll just be there a couple of years. And here, almost 20 years later, we still live in this little town on the Great Plains.
Yeah, that sounds kind of familiar, because that's how I wound up in Muncie, Indiana. Again, it's a bigger city, slightly bigger than Hays, Kansas. So tell us a little bit about Hays and where you live and what it's like.
So Hays is halfway between Denver and Kansas City. I think what's really extraordinary about it is that when you drive out past the Walmart, you really do feel like you've landed on the moon. There's just nothing for miles and miles around. So even though the city itself, it's 20,000, it's not teeny tiny, but we're very isolated geographically. And sometimes I do feel like I live in a different country.
So how did you, so you said you'd be out in Hays for a couple of years. How did you feel when you first landed there? Because you were on the cusp of a pretty intense career at that point, right?
It is true that I was represented by CAA, and I was sort of meeting with movie producers, and it was a very strange time to decide to move to Hays. But for whatever reason, there was just something in me that really wanted that security. The idea of living in New York or LA and just, I don't know, having to cobble together a living while pitching and trying to land jobs just wasn't appealing to me. I was 30 at the time, so maybe that's part of it. Maybe I was like, that's something one can do in their 20s, but I'm done with that. Mm-hmm. So I just really wanted the security. And I also just wanted time to write. I didn't want to, I don't know. I cared more about having time to do the things I wanted to do than I did about certain professional milestones. And I would say my husband and I are very similar in that way, in that we both value time.
Yeah, and that's something we don't that seems to be in very short supply all over the place. But especially I think in that, and because you were talking about the grind really of pitching and getting jobs and getting work and always thinking about the next thing, which is also something that was not appealing to me when I was starting to consider where I was going to wind up. And this sense of you're so focused on that next thing that you can't think about the thing you're working on. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, that's right. And I just think I have a sort of anxious personality, and I was sort of happy to let that go.
So what was the first play you wrote after you moved to Kansas?
So the first play I wrote here was How the World Began, which was very much inspired by this landscape and by the questions that were arising in this landscape. So when we first moved out here, there was another effort to have creationism taught in the school districts in Kansas during that time period. And so there were multiple sort of open community forums with people discussing the issues of, teaching creationism in the classroom. And what I found so interesting about those discussions, was less the intellectual content of them and more the passion and the anger and the psychology that I saw at work among both the folks representing the side of science and those representing the side of religion. And so I took those debates and married it with the a town near us called Greensburg, Kansas. It's actually not that close to us, about 3 hours away.
Right, but it is a real town, yeah.
But it's a real town, yeah. And it was completely destroyed by a tornado sort of the first year that we were out here. So I married all these different elements and created the play How the World Began.
And so have you found, I guess, that your work is kind of inspired by these types of situations where you may find yourself in a place with a group of people you may not agree with either, politically or socially? Does that happen a fair amount?
I think it's certainly true. Like I've always been very influenced by the geography of where I live. So my early plays, a lot of them were set in the South where I grew up. And when I moved out here, I sort of devoured all the literature of the Great Plains, Willa Cather. Ian Fraser has a great book on the Great Plains and read about the Dust Bowl and the history of this area. So I think I've just always been a little bit influenced by geography. And I do have a tendency, I'm just a little bit of a contrarian. So I always want to hear the counter argument of basically any debate. So I think that it's more that quality that influences my plays as much as anything else. I mean, it's not that I was like so fascinated by the creationism science debate, but I certainly was fascinated by the psychology of it.
And there's a passion too in places that you find that you sort of tap into. One of the things that I do love about your work, Catherine, is that you call it being contrarian, right? Or seeing things from opposing points of view. To me, at least, that is one of the hallmarks of an excellent storyteller. And I feel, at least, and this could be, my age, I guess, that we're in a place right now where that is less and less a part of the experience of going to the theater, the movies. It's almost like you're being told what to think rather than being given a situation where you can come to your own conclusion, right?
Yes, I am a real fan of ambiguous endings.
Ambiguous endings.
I know. I love an ambiguous ending. I love to sort of like pose a question to the audience and sort of serve it up to them and then let them leave the theater to discuss it amongst themselves. But truthfully, I did write that play. It's been a while. I mean, I feel like I wrote that at least 15 years ago. So I don't know if I would necessarily have the same approach in our current political environment. But I think that holds true in terms of a strong drive to justify the thoughts and actions of any character that I'm writing.
So talk about the, because you said Hayes is a city of about 20,000. So what kinds of, do you sort of local things as well as, writing plays that are kind of done everywhere? Do you work locally? Are there any opportunities out there?
That's a great question. So when I would say the first decade that I was out here, I very much divided my thinking about work and home. So for the first 10 years, I only worked outside of Hays. And then I came home and I took care of my family and I wrote the next thing. But I had a very divided attitude about work and home. And it's an attitude that I can't entirely explain. I mean, part of it is certainly that all the theater done here is amateur for the most part. Mm-hmm. And it felt very separate from what I was doing professionally. You know, there's not a single equity actor, you know.
Well, sure. Yeah.
100 miles in any direction. So so that was certainly part of it. But I also think maybe it was a bit of both a prejudice on my part and also just busyness on my part, right? So I was raising babies and working in New York and doing things locally just wasn't at the top of my list. But what's so fascinating is that really in the past 5 years, my focus has really changed to local work. And it's been the biggest gift.
Mm. Can you go further with that? Can you tell me why?
I can. So part of it was certainly COVID, right?
COVID, so we're now at a position, I think, right now where we're thinking of the gifts that time maybe gave to us.
Right. So professional theater came to a grinding halt.
It did.
And then when restrictions were lifted, like 30% of theaters across America have closed. I think that's the statistic. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's earth shattering, I should say, in a lot of ways that a lot of institutions who have been there for a while are experiencing some very significant challenges.
Yeah, and there's just not as many opportunities for new plays as there was pre-pandemic. Like I had 2 commissions ready for production when the pandemic hit and all that came to a stop. Mm-hmm. But what developed here is part of it was through a friendship. A man named Alexander Wood, who is a local composer, music director, choir conductor, and founding artistic director of this wonderful music festival called the Ad Astra Music Festival. And it takes place about 30 minutes from where we live. And I knew it was here. They've been running for 10 years, but it really was about 5 years ago that I started getting involved with it. And Alex just has a tremendous vision for rural arts and what should happen in rural spaces artistically. And every summer he raises a ton of money and just creates these really extraordinary music events, marrying professional artists from out of town with local community choirs and doing exciting new work and reinvigorated classics. And when I saw what Alex was doing just 30 minutes away, it really opened my eyes to what was possible in rural spaces.
Oh, that's excellent. And so what happens at the festival? Can you tell me a little bit more about kind of the nitty gritty of it?
Yeah. So a lot happens. So it's usually 3 weekends in the month of July, and they program a variety of musical events. So it might be a traditional musical. It might be a new opera. They commissioned an opera and built a stage in a local park where it was performed a couple of years ago. Last year, they did this experimental German expressionistic chorus.
That's awesome.
Like in the woods by an abandoned farmhouse. And as the chorus wrapped up, the coyotes started responding to the music.
Wow.
And we would be ferried to the space, you know, in SUVs. So they just really create unique musical events. I think one thing that's been fun about it is I am learning about different art forms. You know, I very much come from a writer, playwright, theater perspective. And I don't know that I could have predicted that I would be writing musicals.
That's awesome.
It's part of my career. But that's been part of the fun for me, is to open up this whole new world.
And I think that's also, you know, what we do as artists in general, right? We're constantly we look at what we do, but then also what we want to do, right? Or what we want to be able to do, or what we want to learn how to do. So that's incredible. And just this idea of an opera in the middle of Kansas, on a makeshift stage is incredible to me.
I know. It really is. It's really extraordinary what they do. And I think, I mean, that is sort of the blessing of rural spaces, right? Because if I were in an urban environment, I would never be invited into the classical musical world, right? Like, I'm just too far afield from that. But because there's just so few professional artists where I live, Alex and I found one another. I'm like, okay, how can we help one another create great art here?
And that to me sounds like a slightly different goal, right, than you may have if you were living in an urban environment, which is very much you're kind of siloed into the thing that you do because there's, you know, hundreds or thousands of other people that do the other stuff, right?
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It seems like it's a bit of a different goal that you're not trying to succeed in one particular area. Let's say you're more trying to kind of tell a story in a larger level.
That's right. And that we want to create, meaningful, professional, excellent artistic events where we live. And that's just not the goal that I had when I moved here.
Right.
I wanted to create that in New York, in LA, wherever. And now I want to do that where I live as well. And that's a big shift in thinking.
And the thing I love about this, too, is one of the recurring themes of these conversations that we've had over the last several weeks on our show is that audiences are everywhere. Right. So you can be doing an opera in the middle of a forest with coyotes as your background singers and and people will come. Right. And people will appreciate what you do and respond to what you do.
It's true. And also talent is everywhere. I mean, not everyone has the most pristine training, but man, talent is everywhere. Even, you know, in rural Western Kansas, you can find amazing voices.
Yeah, I believe that. I definitely believe that. And I also want to experience this festival because it sounds wonderful.
Well, next year, Jen.
All right. I'll be emailing you offline. So just be looking for that. So what's next for you? What are you working on now, Catherine?
Well, I'm definitely in musical world. So our first musical is called Ghost Girl. And we just this spring did a professional demo of it. So we're pitching that places. So I'd love to develop that further, probably somewhere outside of Hayes, just because of our needs with it. And then, Jen, you're going to love this. I just finished I'm calling it an existential comedy. It's about three middle-aged ladies who are seduced by a vampire who looks like Paul Giamatti.
Oh, my God. You should see the look on our producer's face right now. I am so there for that.
So I just got notes on that one from my agent. So I'll revise that this summer and then we'll start pitching that one around.
Amazing. So you're planning on then staying in Hayes for the near future. And I know that there's obviously, you know, family there and your husband teaches. What advice do you have for folks who are creators who may find themselves in smaller cities, smaller towns, or rural places?
Well, interestingly, I think it's the same advice that I have for young artists working in urban spaces, which is certainly to find your people. And I know you adhere to that as well.
Absolutely.
Wherever you are, we just, you know, we don't create theater alone. So you have to find your people. And, you know, it may be that your people are an hour away. It may be that you find someone in your backyard, like I was lucky enough to do. But you have to find your people. And then you have to find your funders.
Yeah, well, because they're part of your people.
That's right.
Listen, Catherine, it has been such a joy to spend time with you today and to talk with you about your work and about what it's like living in Hayes. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. What a joy.
This is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. We're going to ask an environmentalist painter, what are you working on? Our co-host Kara Duquette sat down for this week's Weiwo.
We are here today with Anne Maddox. She is an artist, educator, writer, and wildlife advocate, British-born, and currently resides in Marion. Welcome, Anne. It's nice to have you here with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. We would like to ask you, what are you working on?
Well, I am finishing up the last of a series of 6 ecosystem paintings. I've been working on them for over 15 years now, and this will be my last. They're very time-consuming.
Can you explain to us what an ecosystem painting is?
Okay, it's like a little slice of time and space that shows the interconnectedness of both nature and the animals or critters, insects that inhabit them, that space. And I restrict it to a time period, so not going from month to month.
Okay, so you say it's a slice of time and space. So during a certain season or?
Well, in summertime is when you get all of the flowers that grow on the roadsides. The woodland is more of the spring flowers before the trees foliate, and so they get maximum sunshine. But in the summer, you'll get all the roadside and meadow flowers with all the accompanying critters that inhabit that little space and time.
Oh, wonderful. I read that a few years ago you received the Robert Cooper Audubon Society Award for Education Through Art, and they're a chapter of East Central Indiana. And this year, you were the recipient of the Hoosier Women Artists Award. And I wanted to talk to you about the award you got for Ecosystem One. And actually, you've brought Ecosystem One into the studio today, and myself and Luke are amazed. Your work is just so intricate. How would you term your work, your style?
Well, it's realism, obviously. I want people to be able to recognize what they're looking at. And then I have a guide that goes with each painting that gives you the names of all of the plants and insects and birds in the picture.
Yeah, it looks like a map that you could put up next to the work. And without it, you might miss some things because it's so packed with beautiful things. Can you talk a little bit about the colors you utilize?
Well, it's the colors I find in nature. Some of them are very hard to duplicate because the pigments don't always line up with the actual flower. So some things are easier to paint than others. But I try to be as true as I can so that people can recognize it and be able to see it in the wild and know what it is. But I was painting flowers initially. I was teaching in the Bahamas and discovered that there was no local book for other than experts that could identify the flowers. So I figured it couldn't be too hard to just go ahead, and I started painting the flowers that I found and then got help identifying them.
What medium do you use typically to create them?
These are all done in watercolors.
The whole series is watercolors.
Mm-hmm. And I work from the actual plant. I don't use photographs. And there's nowhere you can go and just take a snapshot of what I've got and say that this is the ecosystem, because I go back constantly to the area or similar areas and then add the birds or other critters that I have seen, but not necessarily all at the same time, at the same place. So I work piecemeal and build it up like a jigsaw puzzle.
Well, you said that you're working towards the end of this series after 15 years on it, which is amazing.
They take the minimum of 2 years a piece.
Wow, that's an incredible commitment. I wanted to know what's next for you in your artistic journey.
Well, what I'm doing is moving out of having to do sort of shows and festivals and things. I want to just concentrate on going out as a speaker. Mm. So I'm using my art to illustrate my message. So it's education through art. So I'm finally, since I also trained as a teacher, I'm bringing all my skills and loves together, art, nature, and teaching.
Oh, that's beautiful, right? When everything love can coalesce. How do you utilize your art in teaching?
Well, what I'm trying to tell people I'm trying to open their eyes to understand what is happening in nature, and that is that nature is interconnected in so many ways that we're still learning about, that we're talking about relationships, and we can't pick and choose what we want to save or nurture or whatever. We have to have the whole picture, because when you start missing out certain building blocks, the whole thing collapses, because everything in nature eats and is eaten by something else. So it's the birds rely on the caterpillars. If there aren't enough caterpillars to satisfy the needs of the birds, then the caterpillars won't be around to turn into butterflies. So that it's that balance in nature that needs to be maintained. And we are very uneducated, generally speaking, about how all this works together.
Well, that's a wonderful endeavor. I do think that a lot of people are unaware of the synergy that nature has.
Oh, absolutely. So what I'm trying to do is to encourage people to create habitats in their gardens or yards, because they have control over that area, whereas out in nature, what the farmers don't get, real estate does, all the roadsides are mowed on a regular basis.
Is that what your Wild About Marion Facebook page is?
Yes, it is. And what I'm finding is that there are other communities that have started something similar, but they've given it a different name. So it's becoming quite a sort of movement to encourage city dwellers to take care of nature by offering them a space that they can control.
Well, can you tell us where we can find your art?
Well, I have a Facebook art page. So that's Ann Maddox, Fine Artist. And then I have a Flickr page. I've tried for a website a couple of times, but you're going to outlay quite a lot of money just trying to get something that's functional. It doesn't always translate into getting sales online, unfortunately.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Anne.
Thank you.
And it was a pleasure talking with you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Jen, it is time for the arts calendar.
Here
ready?
We go.
All
I'm
right.
ready.
I'll kick us off. The art of Elizabeth Catlett from the collection of Samela Lewis is now on display at the David Owsley Museum of Art at Ball State University. Elizabeth is widely considered one of the most important African-American artists of the 20th century. Her work blends art and social consciousness while confronting injustices against African-Americans. Catlett is probably best known for her art from the 1960s and 70s when she created politically charged expressionistic sculptures and prints. More information can be found at bsu.edu/DOMA.
Contemporary Christian musician David Crowder is performing Friday, September 20th at Emmons Auditorium. Known for his innovative blend of folk, rock, and electronic elements, Crowder's distinct style is characterized by his soulful vocals and eclectic instrumentation. Details at bsu.edu/Emmons.
Oh, the Indie Jazz Fest kicks off this weekend at various locations in Indianapolis. The kickoff celebration will be at the Jazz Kitchen beginning at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, September 21st, featuring 7 bands and more than 50 all-star jazz performers. The fest ends September 28th with a big show at Everwise Amphitheater at White River State Park with Chaka Khan,
Chaka Khan, and many others. IndieJazzFest.net has all the info you need.
Michelle?
Yes?
Tell me something good.
Tell me something good.
Speaking Chaka of Khan. That, we've got Kinky Boots opening this weekend at Ball State University's theater. Shows will continue through September 29th. The musical, based on a book by Harvey Fierstein and with music and lyrics by Cyndi Lauper, tells the story of Charlie Price, who has reluctantly inherited his father's shoe factory, which is on the verge of bankruptcy. Can an entertainer in need of some sturdy stilettos save the day? Find out. Tickets and more info at bsu.edu.
Love that show. So
me
fun.
Too.
Oh,
me
my
too.
Goodness.
It's going to be a blast.
It is. Absolutely. The 57th annual Levi Coffin Days Festival is September 20th through 22nd in Fountain City. Browse vendors showcasing homemade, new, and unique items. Enjoy live entertainment, kids' activities, catch a parade, and much more. Get all your info at visitrichmond.org.
The Indiana Historical Society is celebrating Latino and Hispanic Heritage Month with several events through October 12th. Indiana Historical Society's traveling exhibit, Be Heard, Latino Experiences in Indiana, and a display of historical folklorico costumes are among the exhibits. IndianaHistory.org is the place to go for the complete schedule.
If you have an event you want Pop of Culture listeners to know about, tell us at IndianaPublicRadio.org/Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at IndianaPublicRadio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, who's fired up for a nap, and was hosted this week by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University. Good night, Luke.